From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That music, and you know you're about to have some fun, vicariously jumping out of airplanes or exploring the lairs of supervillains built inside a volcano or out in space or underwater, and dodging and deploying weapons of all kinds. We don't demand realism from 007 and his chief gadget maker Q, let alone from the bad guys in the films. But as it turns out, the real science related to this stuff used by Bond characters is pretty compelling too. Catherine Harkup is a chemist-turned-author who has watched a lot of these movies and has a new book out to explain whether our favorite scenes could have a basis in reality. It's called Super Spy Science: Science, Death, and Tech in the World of James Bond. Catherine, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much for inviting me back.
We should start with James Bond's creator, Ian Fleming. What was it about his life that positioned him to write these spy novels that were heavy on the outrageous gadgets and weapons?
I think he was blessed with a very vivid imagination, but he also had a very fortunate career in terms of writing spy novels, because he worked in intelligence during the Second World War. He was the secretary, personal assistant to the head of the Naval Intelligence Division, which is a bit of a mouthful. So he was kind of the money penny to the M of the naval wing of the intelligence service. And he was privy to all of the secret plots and plans that were going across the desk. He stood in for his boss in certain meetings, so he knew what was going on. He also had a fascination with gadgetry. So he would talk to these brilliant people who would devise all sorts of extraordinary things to help smuggle information in and out of enemy territory. And all of this kind of stuff he squirreled away in his mind. And he told his colleagues that when the war was over, he would write the spy novel to end all spy novels. And he wrote Casino Royale not long after the war.
Fleming actually carried around his own spy gadgets?
Yeah, he had a pen that he was very proud of showing off that apparently could hold a cartridge of tear gas, or he claimed a cartridge of cyanide for really dangerous missions. Not that he would ever have been allowed on dangerous missions, because he was not the healthiest of individuals and he knew far too much information to be risked falling into enemy hands. So he was very much grounded and stayed safe in London during the war.
Who might have been the real-life inspiration for the inventor character that we all know as Q?
There are lots of possibilities. There were a few individuals, there were lots of people involved in manufacturing these one-off devices or small number devices for very specialist uses. But there was a head of a certain section of the intelligence service called the Quartermaster, hence it was shortened to Q, and his division was responsible for all sorts of weaponry, upgrading it, making it quieter, less easy to detect, as well as looking at all sorts of photographic ideas and other secret gadgets like cracking safes and all sorts of whatnots.
I guess I hadn't realized that the books were successful, but not outrageously so. So I guess if all we know of James Bond is from the movies, we haven't missed anything?
The books are certainly different. Like you say, they weren't bestsellers. I mean, they did very well, but they weren't bestsellers in their day. It definitely took the movies to boost sales and introduce the majority of fans to the world of James Bond. So, yeah, film has a much greater reach than books. They were popular, but they are different to the films. Because it is so dependent on tech and science, and tech and science was moving so fast, especially in the 50s and 60s, that rapid improvements and changes were needed. There were also necessary changes for some of Fleming's more outrageous moments in the books. They had to be toned down and other bits were cranked up a bit.
So as we dive into the movies here and separate the fact from the fiction in the Bond films, I will note for Uber fans that I'm going to skip around in time rather than going in chronological order. In From Russia with Love, our hero finds himself with this character named Rosa Klebb, who wears these like Oxford shoes equipped with a switchblade in the toe, laced with poison that we're told can kill somebody in 12 seconds flat. That actually is a kind of an ancient idea, right? If executed in this movie in a novel way.
Oh, absolutely. The idea of putting nasty substances on the end of sharp objects is nothing new. People have been adding toxins to arrowheads for thousands of years, possibly as long as arrowheads have been in existence. So that's not a new idea. Secreting all of that into a shoe, that is fairly novel, fairly recent. And of course, the selection of toxins has only expanded and been refined with increasing chemical knowledge.
And the real KGB actually did experiment with lethal footwear.
I believe so. I'm not privy to all of their archives, obviously, but it is rumored that they had such devices available to them. Whether they tipped their blades with poison, I don't know. But there are certainly, it may have been an ancient idea, but it certainly didn't die out in recent times. It's been fairly continuous.
One of the coolest scenes in the movie Thunderball takes place underwater. And before that happens, Q has given James Bond this little device that looks a little bit like a kazoo.
Now, in the event of a rebreather not being available, you can use this device. For short periods only, of course, say about 4 minutes.
Clever.
Obviously, you'll only use it as a last resort. It closes to a convenient pocket size.
Assuming one has a convenient pocket.
This one got the British Ministry of Defense very excited. Is that right?
That's true. They saw the film and they saw this tiny little gadget that could allegedly help Bond breathe for an extra 4 minutes underwater by recycling his exhaled breath and extracting back out the oxygen. So that's what we're told in the film. And the Ministry of Defense have been working on something very similar, apparently. And so they very excitedly got in touch with the filmmakers and asked, well, how did you do it? We would very much like to know this. And the filmmakers rather sheepishly had to confess that it was just two soda siphon capsules glued together and the actors were holding their breath. Such things did not exist.
Radio trackers play into the plot of Goldfinger. Did these anticipate the arrival of GPS devices decades later?
Possibly. I think radio trackers have been around for a while in terms of like tracking wildlife and things like that, studying migratory patterns. So these sort of tracker devices, they're certainly possible. The sort of range and the tiny size that is achieved in the Bond films, that is not feasible. These things are minute. They fit into the bottom of a Bond's shoe. Just the battery to power that thing, it just wouldn't fit. So all of the things are, their capabilities are exaggerated, and the size of them is generally made much smaller in the case of these little tracking devices, or much bigger in the terms of lasers and weapons. So scale and practicality are a free-for-all in the films, but the actual idea of it is usually based in some kind of solid science. So maybe it was anticipating GPS, but the satellites that would be needed to equip these trackers certainly weren't available at the time of Goldfinger, which is what, 1963, 64, something like that. Had to wait many decades for that sort of technology.
Since we're speaking about Goldfinger, that film perpetrated maybe the most persistent bit of junk science ever attributed to the movies. The character of Jill Masterson was supposedly killed by skin asphyxiation because her entire body was painted.
Hello?
Hello, Felix. Get over here right away.
What's up?
The girl's dead.
Dink?
Masterson. Jill Masterson. And she's covered in paint. Gold paint.
Would that really happen to somebody who was covered in paint head to toe?
Short answer, no. But actually, it's slightly more complicated than that. I can't imagine that the character Jill Masterson would have had a good time being covered in gold paint, but it certainly wouldn't have killed her as described in the film. So your skin is a very important organ. You can absorb oxygen through your skin, but it's about 2%, and you can get by perfectly well with the other 98% that's going in through your lungs. So she's in no danger of suffocation. However, if the paint blocks the pores in her skin, it disrupts another important function, which is sweating. We have to sweat to control our internal body temperature. And if you block those pores, you can't sweat, and your body will get hotter and hotter and hotter. And if your cells get above a certain temperature, which is 42 Celsius, I can't do the conversion to Fahrenheit, it's 115-ish somewhere, then your cell will start to die. And if enough cells die, then you die. So it is possible that she would slowly cook from the inside, but it would take about 6 hours, which is plenty of time for her to wake up, realize she's a bit hot, and take a cold shower, maybe wash off the paint. So again, everything has been slightly exaggerated, compressed for the benefit of the film, and a more easily interpretable explanation given to the audience, even though it's not true.
A lot of moviegoers also got their first introduction to lasers in Goldfinger. This technology was brand new. Luckily, as you note, Bond villains are always happy to chat about their weird weapons before unleashing them on 007.
I do have a new toy, but considerably more practical. You are looking at an industrial laser, which emits an extraordinary light not to be found in nature. It can project a spot on the moon, or at closer range, cut through solid metal. I will show you.
What sort of challenges did the filmmakers have to make that special effect?
It was a serious challenge because, as you say, lasers were brand new. They weren't really known outside of specialist scientific laboratories. It was absolutely brand new technology. So you had to explain what it was to an audience. And so Goldfinger gets a couple of lines saying it's a special form of light. You can project a spot on a moon, all of which is true. And apparently they did try and wheel in a real laser beam and see if they could film the beam coming out of it, but the cameras couldn't pick it up. But because no one in the audience, apart from a few physicists, would have known what a laser looked like, they could just let their imaginations go crazy. So you have this very elaborate, very high-tech glowing device with a red beam coming out of it that you slowly see advancing towards Bond's nether regions and cutting a line through the gold table that he's been strapped to. So you needed a very striking visual image. And of course, that red line was painted in afterwards so that the audience could clearly see what was going on. And the strip that was being cut out of the gold surface of the table, that was just an ordinary sheet of metal with a line drilled in it, and that had been filled in with solder. And you had a special effects guy under the table with a blowtorch melting the solder out so that you got the impression of this line being cut in the surface of the table. So in actual fact, James Bond was in no real danger because the lasers at the time simply weren't powerful enough to do what is seen on screen. However, Sean Connery probably did have something to worry about because that blowtorch slowly advancing towards him, and this poor special effects guy, he can't see where Sean Connery starts and where Sean Connery stops. So he's waiting for this line of dialogue from Auric Goldfinger. And of course, you know, actors playing villains are going to spin this out as long as possible. And apparently it got quite warm.
When you contacted scientists in different areas and different disciplines to ask questions, were they delighted to walk you through these problems?
I am constantly surprised at how few eyebrows are raised when I ask all sorts of strange questions of people. Presumably, you know, they know me fairly well, and so they're not surprised at all, given, you know, the sort of thing that I'm interested in and my background. But yeah, I do get to ask all sorts of ridiculous questions of various friends of mine in science and engineering world, and they are very accommodating, and they always go above and beyond my initial question to explain, well, maybe it couldn't have worked this way, but if you did this, that and the other, perhaps it could. So yeah, I think everyone loves those kind of silly thought experiments and the opportunity to apply their knowledge to something as fun as James Bond.
Laser technology has come a long way in just a short number of decades. Could something like the wristwatch that Bond uses that's equipped with a laser that cuts through armor plating in GoldenEye, could that actually exist today?
Someone, bless them, there are YouTube videos of people who've tried to make these things.
Today I'll show you how I made a burning wrist laser inspired by superheroes like Iron Man and Secret Agent 007.
I've watched a few of them, and they obviously, these are commercially available lasers that they can get hold of and, you know, tweak a bit. And the best that they've been able to do is if they focus it on a match head, they can get a match head to spark. That's not really going to cut through a few feet of ice in the Arctic Circle. That's going to take a long, long time. So again, unfortunately, yes, laser technology is fantastic, and it has advanced mind-blowing amounts in the few decades since Goldfinger. But I think realistically, James Bond is in trouble if he's trying to use one in his watch. But then he has Q Branch behind him, and who knows what wonderful advances they have managed in their laboratories that hasn't quite yet made it to the general public.
It's funny to me that Bond always ends up using the things given to him by the Q Branch, but is not all that enthusiastic when they're handed over.
No, considering how many times Q has saved his life, I think he should be a little bit more enthusiastic and maybe a little bit more focused when he's getting his briefing on the latest gadget. Q Branch is also incredibly foresighted in what gadgets they might need for this mission. They should give out lottery numbers. They are so good at predicting the future. But having said that, they do get it wrong sometimes. And even if they're given it, if Bond is given a gadget, he doesn't always use it in the way I think Q intended. And occasionally those gadgets, especially the cars, get wrecked before Bond can really make the most of them. So I do understand the Q Branch slight antagonism towards Bond's use of their hard-won results in their laboratory.
The cars are always exquisite. Bond himself never wears any body armor. I guess it would probably mess up those awesome outfits he's wearing. But his cars are usually made to sort of deflect weapons that might be wielded against him.
Quick, get in the car. I'll take care of him.
To make an actual vehicle, if not fully bulletproof, at least resistant?
You need a lot of thick metal or many, many sheets of glass with plastic in or plastic coating in between to hold them together. These things, these cars, if they ever existed, they would weigh a ton. They would not move in any way near the speed that you see on screen. They would be so weighted down with gadgets and motors and just heavy, heavy metal and glass. So yeah, it's just sheer bulk to try and disperse the energy from a bullet before it can penetrate the metal. So the more metal or material that you have, the better.
And the glass is an issue because those layers of plastic in between that keep it from shattering. I mean, if you get enough of that, even if it's clear, it becomes hard to see through it well.
Absolutely. You've got to match the optical qualities of the glass and the plastic film. So the more layers that you build up, the more difficult that gets. And of course, you need to see out of your car and you need to see very well to, you know, keep track of all those henchmen that are coming towards you. So yeah, this the skill of the Q Branch in putting all of that together into a car that not just, you know, works, but actually works extremely well.
Would it be possible to put a working ejector seat into an automobile?
It would, because they did it. Huh. I absolutely love the fact that the Bond films, they rely very much on practical effects. There is very little CGI and camera trickery involved. So when you want an ejector seat, yes, the props department put an ejector seat into a car. It didn't have to launch a whole person. It was a dummy. So it was considerably lower powered. But yes, they did it. Incredible.
It occurs to me reading the book that the special effects folks are really the heroes of these films. If you love James Bond, you should thank the tech crews that make it all look real.
Oh, absolutely. Not just the gadgets, the cars. It's the people driving those cars. It's the stunt coordinators, the stunt actors. They do an absolutely phenomenal job of making everything look so smooth and competent on screen, real professionals at the absolute peak of their profession.
Nerve gas and deadly poisons like gamma gas come up a lot in these films. What's interesting is that it seems like they conveniently take out the target while leaving everybody else in the room unscathed. That seems far-fetched, but I mean, lots of folks will remember that fatal attack on a half-brother of Kim Jong-un, the Korean leader, in 2017 in this just crowded airport. Nobody else was injured as far as we know. What seems to be instrumental in that case, Catherine, is that there were two attackers in quick sequence. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the idea that you want to target your poison towards a certain person, because if you are carrying that poison, that nerve gas, that toxic agent, whatever it is, you would rather not be affected yourself, understandably. Also in terms of storage and just handling, etc. So what a lot of, well, some poisons were developed that were called, there were two parts to them. Two chemicals that when they were mixed together would react together to make the toxic agent, but individually and separated, they were not nearly as bad for you. So they could be safely stored, transported, deployed. So the idea is that if, say, one person went up to someone in an airport and sprayed a liquid in their face, that wouldn't have much an effect on them or their target. Then a second person would come up and maybe wipe something else on the face, and those two chemicals would react, and your individual people who did the wiping and the spraying are fine. But the result is that the person who is the victim of this attack is unfortunately in serious medical trouble. So these two-part poisons or nerve agents certainly are and were a thing. And it was extraordinary to me re-watching Thunderball, that moment when there's a gas that appears to affect only one person in the room. And you start to speculate, oh, well, maybe that's a bit like that incident in the airport. And it's incredible foresight if they did know about those kind of chemicals.
Yeah, the two-part poison made me think about those glues that you buy where there are two tubes of things and you have to combine them in order for the substance to cure.
Exactly the same idea. You have two much more manageable components and you stick them together, chemistry occurs, and you have your product, your desirable end result, whether it's sticking two things together or killing someone.
In A View to a Kill, I think it is, this detective friend of Bond's, this French guy, Aubergine, drops dead instantly after being, it's a very strange scene, after being stabbed by an artificial butterfly on like something like a fishing line attached to a fish hook.
Later this month, Zorin will hold his annual sales at the stud near Paris. Security is formidable, but the key to this mystery is there. And I, Achille Aubergine, intend to find it.
This seems completely out of the question. First of all, is there any substance that can like basically penetrate the skin and instantly kill someone?
Instant is a very difficult thing. There are certainly poisons that are extremely fast acting and you might be unconscious very, very quickly, even if you are not in fact dead at that point. But considering this, Monsieur Aubergine goes face down in his dinner and no one helps him, I think he's a goner. So he might not actually be dead at that moment, but he might as well be. But the idea of using like poisons on the end of sharp implements, as we said, like Rosa Klebb. You know, these things have been around forever. And the incident in the Eiffel Tower in A View to a Kill, when you're watching it, it seems very silly, very strange in the context of the film. But then me, with my hand over the pause button, I started to think about a similar incident, real life incident that happened in London. A guy called Georgi Markov felt a sting in the back of his leg and turned around, saw someone with an umbrella who dropped, you know, picked up an umbrella off the floor, apologized, crossed the road and disappeared. And a few days later, Georgi Markov was dead of ricin poisoning that had been fired, had been introduced into his body through a pellet that had been fired either from an adapted umbrella or some kind of pistol, and the umbrella was a distraction. So the idea of fishing hooks and the Eiffel Tower suddenly doesn't seem so strange.
It is bizarre to think that real scientists, like literal evil scientists, most of them are, you know, working so hard for good, are sitting in a lab somewhere coming up with this stuff.
Yeah, I have to say that the vast majority of scientists are not.
Of course. That's what I'm saying.
And even a lot of these substances that have been discovered to be very toxic or devices that have been found to be particularly lethal, they were not always designed with that intention. So a lot of the nerve agents were initially developed as insecticides. People were trying to kill insects, not people. And, you know, pests that would destroy crops, all very worthy work. It's just that you notice the side effects of some of these things, and the side effects become more important than the intended effect.
In Casino Royale, Bond finds himself reeling from a poisoned drink. How does he get out of that one?
Oh, well, it's a wonderful moment in Casino Royale. He staggers out of the bit. Well, before he staggers out of the casino, he grabs a glass, some salt, and he drinks down salt water to make himself vomit, which is a good idea to remove whatever poison he's ingested before it can work its way into his body proper. This is how you might be treated in a hospital if you had swallowed something that was suspected to be causing you harm. I should say that if you think you've swallowed something nasty, please don't do the salt and water trick yourself. That is not good. Please call the emergency services. But James Bond is in a bit of a fix. So he improvises. He vomits up a lot of the poison, but he's still having the effects. He staggers out to his car, which is handily equipped with what seems to be a complete medical service. He plugs himself in, and this device in his car is able to analyze his blood and tell him what he has been given within a few minutes. And he's in contact with London, which is the only credible bit, really, the being in touch with London, the whole blood analysis thing. You can't do that. I don't think there are devices that would fit in a glove compartment that would do that.
Bond's been poisoned. He's going into cardiac arrest.
Stay calm.
And don't interrupt, because you'll be dead within 2 minutes unless you do exactly what I tell you.
I'm all ears.
Remove the defibrillator from the pouch. Do not know what it is yet. I'm still scanning.
But anyway,
this is why Elizabeth Holmes went to jail, right? At Theranos.
But I do understand why, you know, a 00 agent would need a medical kit in their car. I mean, that should be set fairly standard issue, I would have thought. Anyway, they're monitoring, they say it's Digitalis, which is a heart drug. And of course, they're monitoring his heart rate, and you can see the number of beats per minute going up and up and up and up. And clearly Bond is in trouble. But that is not what the Digitalis does to your heart, unfortunately. He is advised to take Novocaine, a shot to his neck. That's actually very good advice if you've got a Digitalis overdose. You then need to go to a hospital and get proper treatment, not go back to a casino and continue a game of poker, but details. But yeah, all of this, it doesn't matter. It's a very dramatic scene. And of course, we see Bond's heart effectively give up on him, and he has to be shocked back to life.
It is remarkable. We don't see him spending a whole lot of time convalescing. But if all these things happened to a real human, I mean, there would be a lot of hospital time to log.
Absolutely. And this is one of the many contrasts between the books and the films. The James Bond of the books, he ends up broken. He is wheeled away in an ambulance. He is dug out of the rubble. He has time off to recuperate. But I you know, no one wants to watch James Bond slowly recovering, you know, shuffling towards the toilet from his hospital bed, sipping his orange juice. You know, that's not fun. We want to see him getting hurt, doing all the action stuff. We're not interested in the recovery. I have to say, though, the Daniel Craig era, as opposed to all the other Bonds that went before, you know, Roger Moore just stood up, dusted, you know, brushed the dust off his dinner jacket and carried on. Daniel Craig's James Bond, he gets hurt. He is clearly damaged and does need a bit of time off between missions.
Poison drinks, though, are a weapon of espionage. We know for the Russians. Remind us of what happened to Alexander Litvinenko in 2006.
So Alexander Litvinenko was a former Russian national, now British national. He went to meet some Russian colleagues at a bar in London. When he arrived, there was tea there, which he drank down, and that tea was laced with polonium-210, which subsequently caused his death.
All right, Catherine, Bond villains are like never content to just live in a condo in a nice central location, you know, walkable to the grocery store. You especially like Blofeld's volcano lair, and it makes you wonder what it would take to recruit all the staff members to show up every day and work in one of these places. Just take us through that thought exercise.
Well, these Bond villains, they do like to live in great comfort and very stylish, imposing, but rather remote locations.
Ventilator fans to normal. Open shutters.
Reception complete.
I shall be in my apartment. I may send for you later.
And they do go for the extravagant, and they are the volcano lair, it does stick in the mind. It is so impressive. Who wouldn't want to live inside a hollowed out volcano? Well, I don't think I would. I like the idea of it. I think the practicalities would not be much fun at all. Apart from being outrageously expensive to shovel out all of the debris that's going to be in there. And then all, you know, monorails don't come cheap. There's an awful lot of stainless steel, the retractable roof. Then you've got to pay the minions who are going to keep that stainless steel polished, the mechanism for the roof working, because there's going to be, well, if you're going to go for a volcano, go for an extinct one. Blofeld does not go for an extinct volcano because, spoilers, the volcano erupts at the end of the film. This means that there is active, you know, magma lava at some level beneath his opulent hideout. So you're going to have, it's going to be nice and warm, lovely hot showers, but there's going to be lots of toxic gases that are going to be corroding all of that metal and poisoning your minions. So you're going to run through them at quite a rate. It is an expensive operation, but by God, does it look good.
A villain, I guess, could theoretically build a hideout in orbit like Hugo Drax has in Moonraker, but like no amount of stealth technology could render this place invisible, right?
Absolutely not. I mean, we have an International Space Station. People do live in orbit, perhaps not in the luxury that Hugo Drax demands, but people do live in space. And that, for me, is incredible. The downside of Hugo Drax's plan is, you know, he's built this secret space station apparently with no one noticing. The International Space Station, you can see it with the naked eye. You cannot hide something that big. But fair play to Hugo Drax. He pulled it off in the film.
His evil plan is to wipe out humankind with some kind of biological weapon and replace them with ideal specimens to repopulate the planet.
Allow me to introduce you to the airlock chamber. Observe, Mr. Bond, your route from this world to the next.
And you, Dr. Goodhead, your desire to be America's first woman in space will shortly be fulfilled.
Leaving you on your flying stud farm, conceiving your new master of race.
If you like, yes.
And of course, anyone not measuring up to your standards of physical perfection will be exterminated.
Certainly.
Happy to say you conclude this probably would not work, but why not?
Well, he has discovered a chemical that, again, he's found one of those scientists that look at chemical structures and go, oh, let's make this worse. So they've taken something that apparently used to cause infertility, and they've tweaked the structure so that it will just kill you. But only humans, which is important because you still want all of the other animals and plants so that you have a livable, functioning planet to return to, unless you're thinking of staying up in space, which has other consequences. You want to return to Earth to repopulate it with your beautiful people. But in terms of deploying this chemical across the entire surface of the globe in doses sufficient to kill everybody, and then that substance, whatever it is, has to break down. Otherwise, when you go back, it's still going to be there and it's just going to kill you. So this particular chemical has a lot of work to do, and then it has to disperse itself and become innocuous rather quickly. Frankly, if you've got something that nasty, the best place to be launching it from is space. I understand why Hugo Drax has gone to all the trouble of building his secret space station so that when this devastation occurs on the Earth, he is nowhere near it.
What about, say, the you only live twice pond filled with piranhas? Would that be a good deterrent to keep intruders at bay?
Yes, which exotic pet should you go for once you've built your lair? Piranhas are a very interesting fish, but again, they are an animal that have suffered from, they've suffered from a lot of bad press. And this myth that they can strip a body of the flesh to the bone in a matter of seconds, it is a myth. If you have starved your piranhas for some time, so they're very, very hungry and they're maybe quite stressed out, yes, if you do push a henchman into their pond, they probably will eat him quite quickly. So I don't know. The first henchman into that piranha pond, yes, he's probably in trouble. The second hench person to go into the pond, I think, has less to worry about because you've probably got some sated, well-fed piranhas by that stage, and they're probably just going to ignore you.
And the classic Bond villain pet, of course, a shark. They can, we know, be deadly, but they are not nearly as good at like smelling human blood from miles away as we've been led to believe.
No, they do have fantastic sense of smell, taste, however it is they detect substances in the water. But, you know, a few drops of blood in many, many, many gallons of water, no. Even sharks aren't that good, I'm afraid to say. And sharks, they just do not make good pets. They are apex predators who swim thousands of miles to great depths, and they are not good in small ponds being fed on henchmen. They don't even particularly like humans. All of those shark attacks that you read about, these are mostly exploratory bites of sharks that, oh, something strange in the water, give it a bit of a chew to find out what it is, and then spit it back out again. The unfortunate thing is that sharks, particularly great white sharks, have an awful lot of very sharp teeth and a very powerful bite. So even an exploratory nibble can cause serious injury. If you don't receive medical attention, that can be fatal. But if sharks really did like the taste of humans, humans invade their shark's personal space quite a lot. There would be far more deaths every year if they really did get a taste for humans. So yeah, don't keep them in ponds. Don't keep feeding them henchmen. It's not good for the fish. It's not good for the henchmen. It's not going to be much of a deterrent.
It seems almost banal, I realize, Catherine, to bring up guns, but they do occasionally appear in Bond films, often with a silencer attached. Turns out silencers don't work the way they do in movies.
No, I'm afraid most films you would believe that you put a silencer on the end of a gun and it's essentially silent, or you hear this, pop or a slight thud noise and that's it. You'd blink and you miss it, or you'd get distracted and you'd miss it. That's not what silencers really do. They muffle the sound of a gun. They slow the explosive gases that emerge from the end of the muzzle, but they don't make them silent. And so it might be a confusing sound if you heard a silenced or a muffled gun go off. But as you say, there are one or two guns in James Bond's world, and I imagine he and everyone around him knows perfectly well what a muzzled gun sounds like when it's fired. So I don't really see what they're disguising and from who, but they do seem to persist with these things. But there you are.
So lots of us go to James Bond movies because we want to eat popcorn and watch stuff be blown up. I didn't realize that actual bombs don't necessarily create like a spectacular fireball. But in the movies, those are added. Sometimes things go awry, though. What happened on the set of Fireball?
So in Thunderball, there's a brilliant bit at the end of the film where the boat crashes into the reefs and it explodes, because any vehicle that crashes, of course, in a Bond film will explode. And so the special effects team had rigged this up with lots of explosives, but it was an explosive and a, I believe, rocket fuel that the particular expert wasn't terribly familiar with, and he over-egged it slightly. When the explosion went off, apparently it put out the windows miles away. They were lucky no one was hurt. There was debris raining from the sky minutes after the explosion, and the boat wasn't just destroyed, it was obliterated. And so I think they very sheepishly kind of packed everything up and ran away as quickly as possible. But yes, these explosions, they are very powerful, and they are done by experts who know what they're doing, and they do rig up lots of flammable material around so that you can actually see the explosion, see these big balls of flames, because that's what we all love. A big bang and a cloud of dust isn't nearly so exciting.
Thunderball also saw the electrocution of this member of a crime syndicate right in his chair during some kind of committee meeting.
I have satisfied myself that one of you is clearly guilty of embezzlement. Spectre is a dedicated fraternity whose strength lies in the absolute integrity of its members. The culprit is known to me. I've decided on the appropriate action.
I gather this is something we don't need to worry about, even if we didn't make our numbers for the third quarter.
I would be skeptical about turning up to any Spectre meeting. I would be very cautious. But yes, the idea that you could just sit in a chair, this particular chair, it is beautifully designed. It looks very sleek, but there's not much in terms of conductive material to get the electricity into this unfortunate man's body. But what you see on screen is kind of a tamed down version of what electrocution is.
My guest this hour is Catherine Harkup, author of Super Spy Science: Science, Death, and Tech in the World of James Bond. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do the cyanide capsules embedded in a crown that spies always seem to have in these movies, are those in use in the real world?
Versions of them were in use during the Second World War. They were called L pills, and it was cyanide in a glass capsule. And they were given to pilots who were flying into enemy territory on secret missions. And the idea was that you would bite into this glass capsule, release the cyanide, and you would be dead very, very quickly before you could divulge any secrets or any of your plans. And cyanide was chosen because it is a very rapid poison or fast-acting poison. The idea that you would take something like an L pill and put it into your tooth, as Silver does in Skyfall, I worry about that. I mean, if it's designed to be broken by just biting. What? How do you just eat an ordinary meal, especially if you've got crunchy food? I imagine he's just on soups and liquid diets just to avoid cracking his own tooth. Seems an odd place. Also, the effects that you see in the film, half of his jaw kind of corroded away, that is not what happens with cyanide. It looks very impressive. It's a very important dramatic moment in the film, but in terms of the science, it's way off.
Quickly before I let you go, does looking into the actual science behind this diminish your enjoyment of these movies or enhance it?
It enhances it, I think, because even the bits that are silly and you go, oh, so close, they could have actually done that right and it wouldn't have affected the film, it wouldn't have changed it very much, and that's sometimes a little bit disappointing. But I was always surprised at how some idea of science was used, like the space shuttles in Moonraker, like the knife shoe in From Russia with Love. There is a kernel of truth in there, and it is the job of entertainment to entertain. So you crank it all up to 11 and you just run with it. And I have no problem with that at all. It's a fun thought experiment to go, well, if I was going to wipe out humanity and repopulate the earth with my beautiful people, does Hugo Drax's plan hold up? Because I'm never going to do it, but I do get to write about it. So,
Catherine Harkup is a chemist turned author. Her latest book is called Super Spy Science: Science, Death, and Tech in the World of James Bond. Catherine, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making time to talk.
Thank you so much. It was great fun.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.